This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Iran is at the top of the news again this week after a confrontation in the Strait of Hormuz between a British-flagged oil tanker and Iranian vessels. Britain's ambassador to the U.S. has resigned after his frank and disparaging assessments of the Trump administration were leaked. Another political crisis is playing out in Asia. Beijing has failed to reassure residents in Hong Kong that it will not try again to push through a hugely controversial extradition law. More protests are in the works. And Turkey has upset the U.S. and other NATO allies by going ahead with buying a missile defense system from the Russians. Plenty to discuss today on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us to help make sense of this week's top international stories is Amna Nawaz, a national correspondent and some anchor for the PBS NewsHour. Amna, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dmitry Sevastopoulou is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Dmitry, welcome.
Thank you.
And Laura Seligman is a Pentagon correspondent for foreign policy. Laura, welcome.
Thank you.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts, so email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's start with Iran. Tensions with Iran are still high, and as we said, not just with the U.S. A British tanker traveling through the Strait of Hormuz on Wednesday was approached by Iranian boats that tried to make it stop. It didn't work. The Iranian boats stood down, but it was one more move in a series of conflicts with Iran in the Middle East. Amna, let me start with you. We've heard about the strained relationship between America and Iran, but what happened here? What about the UK and Iran?
Yeah, the tensions have been rising there as well. It's important to say also the Iranians have basically denied there was any kind of confrontation. And the British have said, look, it was concerning and we want Iran to do what they can to de-escalate the situation. But there has been some back and forth between those two countries, specifically on maritime traffic, specifically there. Last week, the British basically helped to facilitate the seizure of an Iranian tanker that they've been holding on to. They said it was because of evidence that it was carrying oil to Syria, and then that was in breach of EU sanctions there. That has been part of an escalating series of tensions between the two countries. And the British since then have been sending in their tankers through this strait, which is a crucial maritime pathway, with Royal Navy ships. That's something Iranian officials have kind of made fun of and mocked them for doing. But tensions have been rising there as well. And that's, of course, all happening on the backdrop of the U.S., which is involved in all of this somehow, pulling out of the JCPOA last year. Iran has been trying to push those other three EU signatories to that deal to do something about it, to ease the sanctions, to help make a deal with them. And meanwhile, Iran themselves are pulling out piece by piece from that deal. So it's all interconnected. No country is immune from that tension right now.
And Amna, just to be clear, when we talk about British tankers having Royal Navy escorts, we're talking about ships that carry oil, mm-hmm. having armed escorts to make their route.
That is right, which is unsustainable for Britain, and everyone knows that. But it does speak to how serious that situation is and how high the tensions are.
Dmitry, could we back up a little bit and can we get a little bit of perspective on how we got to this point? I mean, this is not the first time that Iran has made moves against oil tankers off its coast.
No, there's been a series of things that have happened. And historically, there's also been, you know, things like this have happened in the 90s. So there's kind of a repeating pattern. But what we have now is, you know, as Amna said, after the U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal last year, tensions have been rising. In the last few months, things have gone to an even higher level. So you've had attacks on commercial ships. You've had attacks on oil tankers, which the U.S. has blamed on Iran. And Iran has said they had nothing to do with them. You had Iran shooting down an American surveillance drone, which Iran has admitted to. They said it was over Iranian airspace. The Americans say, no, it was over. It was in international airspace. And then you have these recent events with Britain and the tanker. Then on the other hand, you have the Trump administration gradually ratcheting up or dramatically ratcheting up sanctions on everyone from the ICRG, which is the elite military in Iran, to the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, the Ayatollah. And threatening to put sanctions on the foreign minister, Javid Zarif. So there's a whole thing, combination of things happening together. The U.S. and its supposed European allies are split over how you tackle Iran. And Iran is gradually doing things that would be in breach of the Iran nuclear deal. It's breached the 300 kilogram limit on the stockpile of enriched uranium it's allowed to keep under the deal. It started enriching uranium to a higher level than is allowed under the deal as a way to pressure the Europeans to provide a kind of relief to the Iranians that they need because of the American sanctions. So you have the Iranians at odds with the Europeans, the Iranians at odds with the Americans at odds with the Europeans. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any kind of coherent strategy in the U.S. in terms of how you get to a solution.
With regards to the nuclear deal, Laura, there was a United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency meeting in Austria this week, an emergency meeting to discuss the deal and what Dmitry was just describing, these recent moves by Iran to break its end of the bargain. Were there any big takeaways or outcomes or action items from this UN meeting, or was it just a chance for everyone to wring their hands in the same room?
Right. So the biggest thing that I took away from that is that this is a sign that the effort to kind of drive a wedge between the U.S. And Europe is actually maybe working. One important thing to remember is that Iran really has no incentive to stop causing these problems in the Gulf or stop enriching uranium. Their economy that totally depends on oil is shot, and their only recourse really is to get sanctions relief from Europe. So they're gambling that doing these provocative actions in the Gulf will drive up oil prices, making Europeans feel the pinch and perhaps try to compromise. So during this meeting of the IAEA, the U.S. got pushback from Russia, China, and Europe, and they blamed the Trump administration for pulling out of the JCPOA for these problems that Iran is doing in the Gulf. So this doesn't seem to have a really easy solution, and these efforts may be working. It's not clear whether the U.S. is going to take any actions against Iran right now, but one thing that the U.S. military and the State Department may be trying to get progress on is to create a coalition, a maritime coalition, to protect tankers and commercial vessels in the Gulf.
And can we be clear, Laura, this increase in enriched uranium, what is that mean? Does that mean that Iran is closer to building a nuclear weapon?
So it means that Iran is slightly closer to producing a nuclear weapon. They're still many months away, but the first violation was enriching above the 300 kilogram level, like Dmitry said. The second violation was enriching to higher levels of uranium, so above 3.67% to 4.5%, I believe. Highly enriched uranium, which you need to build a nuclear bomb, is enriched beyond 90%. So it's going to take many months for them to enrich uranium to that level, and they need, I think, 25 kilograms of highly enriched uranium for the core of one nuclear bomb. Then they still have to get that into from gas to metal. They have to fit it with an explosive before actually making the bomb.
Amna?
And one of the things important to point out as they work towards that ultimate goal, as many believe, is that they've already set the clock ticking. They've basically said every 60 days, we're going to take another step that breaches that JCPOA, that nuclear deal, because until somebody does something to ease some of the sanctions pressure here. So they've already said, we're going to be working towards that. And two other things that are important to point out. One is that they are still in compliance with the IAEA investigators. They're still working with them. They're still granting them access. And that is key for a number of reasons, because people say, experts who've been watching this and who can really take a look at the threat, say if they break with that relationship, if they stop cooperating with the IAEA, that is when the real concern begins.
Dmitry?
I think that the one other thing that's important to point out is that what Iran is trying to do is to put pressure on the Europeans to provide some kind of financial relief. The difficulty for the Europeans is the Americans are essentially saying, if you provide any relief to the Iranians via any channel, we're going to sanction you. So European companies have essentially pulled out of Iran. So it's very difficult to see what the Europeans can do in any kind of a substantial way that will make the Iranians happy without suffering the wrath of the Trump administration.
Now, Laura, I'd love you to respond to a comment from David, who wrote on our Facebook page, I really hope the war hawks in Washington realize Iran is much better prepared for war than Iraq was.
Well, I think it's actually important just to note that there is a question of whether Iran would actually pursue a nuclear weapon. It's not really clear that it's not really clear that it would be allowed under their religion. I believe the foreign minister has said that Iran will not become a nuclear state. And it's also not clear that it would really have strategic value. Israel already has nukes. The Saudi Arabia would likely get a nuclear weapon if Iran does. And now that could change with additional provocation from the U.S., such as if the U.S. were to launch a strike against Iran, then Iran could decide that getting a nuclear weapon is the best way to deter a U.S. attack. To the question, Iran does have a very strong military aside from nuclear weapons, so that they're more likely to lean on that.
Well, and maybe the play, theoretically, and again, I'm just spitballing here, but maybe the play is not to use a nuke, but maybe to sell one. I mean, Iran borders Pakistan, which is a nuclear state.
That's true. And that is definitely the concern that's been expressed by military and defense officials. The proliferation of a nuclear weapon is very dangerous.
Right. Speculation again, of course.
But the other thing is, I mean, Pakistan already has nuclear weapons, so they don't actually need Iran to sell any to them.
Let me read one quick statement from Iran's ambassador to the UN agency that told a German newspaper on Wednesday, quote, "What we're doing only has one aim. We want to preserve the nuclear treaty. Everything can be reversed within a single hour if all of our partners in the treaty would just fulfill their obligations in the same way," unquote. I'm pretty sure they're talking about the United States with regards to that. And when we come back, I'd love to get your sense of that. We are speaking to Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour, Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times, and Laura Seligman of Foreign Policy Magazine. Much more to discuss when we come back, including this bad week between the United States and the United Kingdom when diplomacy kind of fell apart between the two. It's funny what happens when people find out that what you say isn't quite what you meant. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Laura Seligman of Foreign Policy, Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour, and Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. A few more things about Iran before we move on and talk about Europe. Amna, I'd love to get your reaction to that statement that Iran's ambassador to the UN agency told the German newspaper on Wednesday. Here it is again, quote, "What we're doing only has one aim. We want to preserve the nuclear treaty. Everything can be reversed within a single hour if all of our partners in the treaty would just fulfill their obligations in the same way," unquote. Who are they referring to when they say all of our partners?
Oh, they're most definitely talking about the United States. I mean, it's easy to read between the lines on that. And look, I think this underscores just how massive the repercussions have been of the Trump administration's decision to just unilaterally pull out of the deal. And we knew it was coming. He ran on this. He campaigned on it. He called it the worst deal ever in history. And still, to this day, more than a year later, we're seeing that the ramifications of that decision extend far beyond just what the U.S. is able to participate in. The only thing that's happened since then has been a ratcheting up of tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Step by step, Iran pulling out of the deal, creating more of a threat, putting more pressure on our EU partners and allies who are still signatories to the deal to try to do something to mitigate the effects of the sanctions. And now you see the U.S. still calling for an increase in sanctions. Even at the IAEA meetings this week, you had the U.S. ambassador there participating in those talks and saying, we need to get you on board. We need to be ratcheting up and increasing these sanctions. There's no exit ramp to the discussion right now.
Laura?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, it was really interesting to watch the first Democratic presidential debates a couple weeks ago, because when asked about the Iran deal, none of the candidates said that they would return to the deal as it was. They all said that they would only return to a strengthened deal. So it seems like the table is set for the U.S. if it wants to try to restart negotiations to try to get some inclusion of Iran's, as they call it, malign activity, ballistic missile launches, proliferating weapons of mass destruction to terrorists.
Which was a criticism of the original deal, that it covered certain nuclear activities but not certain weapons that might be involved.
Right, exactly. Kind of like I was saying on the previous segment, Iran having nukes is not the biggest problem in the Middle East. It's the ballistic missiles. It's the sponsoring terrorists around the world, even to Africa and South America.
And one quick question, Dimitri, before we move on, just to clarify, Jonathan tweeted, since the U.S. pulled out of the Iran deal, is there actually an Iran deal? Your guests keep talking as if the deal still exists. I'm confused.
Well, the deal technically still exists, but the Americans have withdrawn from it. The Europeans remain committed to it. Iran remains committed to it, but has started to breach the terms of the deal. At some point, if they go, you know, a certain length and breach it in many, many more ways, I think it'll be the conclusion will be that the deal really doesn't exist at all in practice.
Let's shift gears and talk about Europe, where it has been a bad week for relations between the UK and the US. On Wednesday, the ambassador to the US quit. His resignation was prompted by earlier leaked diplomatic cables from the British ambassador that described President Trump as inept. The president hit back on Twitter, calling the ambassador a very stupid guy and a pompous fool. Then it got worse in London. Boris Johnson, who is favored to become the new prime minister by some, failed to rally behind Sir Kim Darroch, the ambassador, when he was asked on TV if he would keep him in that post. The outrage to that was pretty swift. Here is a Minister of Parliament, Sir Alan Duncan, responding to that.
What is clear is that Boris Johnson did not defend him. And I think that is spineless. I think it's a failure of leadership. And I think his protests today are insincere guff.
That's Sir Alan Duncan, a Minister of Parliament, using such strong language. Guff. Sir, please, this is public radio. This has a lot of things going on. I mean, there's the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. There are these cables, which were probably never meant for public consumption. But then on top of that, there's this election. And there was a TV debate this week on ITV, one of the commercial broadcasters in the UK. So this is not purely diplomatic. Boris Johnson's trying to make some political hay with this, too.
None of this is happening in a vacuum. And this is most definitely not just about diplomatic cables, which you're absolutely right, are never meant to be consumed, certainly not by the general public, definitely not about the people they're writing about in the cables. To be clear, Kim Darroch was just doing his job, the same job that any other diplomat in Washington or any city around the world would do. I've covered enough countries that have what you describe as rough or tense relations with the U.S., where our own ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors on the ground, have to speak very frankly and very honestly when they're sending these cables back, because that's how the information gets where it needs to go to form leverage and influence and relationships and policy. That's just part of the job. The difference is here, the quiet part got said out loud, and we don't know where those cables came from. We don't know how they got leaked, but we do know that politically they are advantageous for Boris Johnson, who is right now locked in a head-to-head battle for the prime minister position, and they do benefit him. I mean, this is someone who has said that if there is no deal for Brexit, for Britain to exit the European Union by the time the deadline comes around, they will leave with no deal. Darroch is not an ally of Johnson's. It works to Boris Johnson's advantage to be able to say this or to have this out there and not have to defend him. And to be clear, in that debate, his opponent, Jeremy Hunt, did come step up to defend the ambassador here. So this isn't just about diplomacy. This isn't just about the ambassador. He was sort of collateral damage in a larger political debate.
With regards to the diplomatic part, Laura, just a purely diplomatic part, it seems like there was, well, I wonder how you see it, that there may have been nowhere else for this to go. When the president says he's not going to deal with you anymore, that's kind of it.
Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, it did seem like an inevitable conclusion. But I think it's important to point out that his resignation and everything that's happened here will have a chilling effect on the remaining diplomats. A lot of people, like you touched on, may think twice before offering their honest assessments, which is what is so important in the diplomatic world. But this is not actually the first time that something like this has happened. In 2010, WikiLeaks published a massive stash of documents about how U.S. ambassadors really felt about their hosts. So you had a senior State Department official posted in Italy calling then Prime Minister Berlusconi feckless, vain, and ineffective. So this was obviously caused a lot of backlash, but also a lot of self-censorship, leaving Washington sort of out of the loop a little bit in what was going on in the diplomatic circles.
Dimitri?
I mean, I just point out that, for example, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, Rick Grenell, has said much worse things on the record, including to our newspaper and others, about Germany and Angela Merkel than Kim Darroch ever wrote in any of the cables that we've seen. I mean, the truth is the British on kind of Monday and Tuesday, Kim Darroch thought that he could probably ride this out because, frankly, Donald Trump tweets about a lot of people and many of them are still in their jobs, even if a few of them have gone. The final straw was Boris Johnson. I mean, Kim Darroch watched the debate between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt. And after that debate, he realized Boris Johnson has thrown me under the bus and he decided to resign. And I take a slightly different view on how it's playing in the UK. Actually, there's been a huge backlash against Boris Johnson and a lot of criticism that he's not willing to defend the Foreign Service, which he led as Foreign Secretary. And the question is whether he's willing to kind of suck up to Donald Trump and throw his own country under the bus if and when he becomes Prime Minister. But Boris Johnson was the final nail in the coffin. And Boris Johnson actually called Kim Darroch the next day and apologized. But by then, it was too late.
We should also note that President Trump also attacked the outgoing Prime Minister, Theresa May. He tweeted that she ignored his advice and on Brexit went, quote, her own foolish way, a disaster. Unquote. Mrs. May apparently thought that crossed the line. Here's part of what she told the House of Commons.
Good government depends on public servants being able to give full and frank advice. And I hope the House will reflect on the importance of defending our values and principles, particularly when they are under pressure.
It's Theresa May, the outgoing Prime Minister, speaking to the House of Commons. Dimitri, this is kind of the thing that ambassadors are supposed to be able to do. I mean, they put a good face for their nation to their host nation in terms of official diplomatic dealings, but behind closed doors, they kind of got to speak to their bosses in the way that allows them to make decisions.
Well, they've got two jobs to do. One job is to make friends in the U.S. administration here so that you know what's going on and you can advance your country's interests. And your other job is to tell your prime minister or your president what's actually happening here. I mean, with Theresa May, I mean, the criticisms from Donald Trump are interesting because he made exactly the same criticism standing beside her at her country residence in Chequers in the U.K. when he visited in 2017. He said, you know, I gave Theresa some advice and she didn't take it. I think she should have taken it. So this is not the first time she's heard that. It's very easy for Donald Trump to criticize Theresa May now because within 2 weeks, she's not going to be the prime minister.
One other UK story before we move on that received a little less attention but is very significant was a vote that was taken to make same-sex marriage and abortion legal in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is part of the UK, and with this amendment that passed, it means that now the entire United Kingdom has legalized same-sex marriage and abortion. The Catholic-Protestant divide is very real in Northern Ireland, but it took Parliament in London to change these laws, right?
Right. And basically those laws, well, I think it's important to point out it hasn't changed the law necessarily, that this the vote comes basically in a power vacuum in Northern Ireland because the governing coalition collapsed back in 2017. So this is a vote that could change the law, but then that could be changed back once that new coalition comes into power in Northern Ireland. But yeah, actually, culturally, it is huge. It not only highlights the divide between the two regions, but also shows you just how quickly things can change on the ground. I think polling has shown that by and large, people do support those laws being changed. So we'll see if the laws actually catch up to that.
Dimitri?
I mean, just historically, as someone who grew up in Dublin, what's interesting is the Catholic majority in Northern Ireland are more supportive now of same-sex marriage and abortion than the unionists who want to remain in the UK. So there's been a total cultural change in Northern Ireland in the last 20 years. But until the power vacuum problem is fixed, very little is going to happen there.
Let's talk about Germany. Chancellor Angela Merkel has been in the news after she was seen shaking somewhat violently during three different public appearances over the last month. Yesterday, she broke protocol and sat down instead of standing up while national anthems played during a state visit. After that event, she told reporters not to worry about her. Angela Merkel is 64. She's led Germany since 2005 and announced she will step down 2 years from now. Laura, what do we take from this story? I mean, the fact that she's shaking, it feels almost like the Hillary Clinton story where there was that shot and people say, oh, is Hillary Clinton well enough to lead the country or is she falling apart? Like, what is this story really about?
That's true. And let's not forget Michelle Bachmann back in 2012 when or 2011 when she had migraines and all of a sudden people were questioning her ability to serve as president.
Because I don't remember hearing anybody say that about Bob Dole.
Right.
When he was running. I don't hear that about male candidates or male heads of state when they shake or when they're weak or when they're frail. I've only heard this lately about women.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. But on the other hand, you know, when you're dehydrated and you're visibly shaking, I do think that it is fair to question someone. I think if that were President Donald Trump up there and he's shaking, I think it would be fair to question the health or at least express some concern about the health of that leader. But it is unfortunate that likely this is happening in the background of some sexist remarks.
What would it mean? Just setting that aside for a second, what would it mean if Angela Merkel had to leave office sooner than planned? She's played an increasingly important role in Europe lately, especially as Europe has been changing politically so much so fast.
Angela Merkel's role, not just in Europe, but in the world, has changed significantly with the election of Donald Trump here in the U.S. And a lot of that sort of leader of the free world type center of gravity has shifted towards her. One of the reasons I think this resonated and this caught so many people's attention is because of her reputation. She has been known for her stamina. She is the one who is up before anyone else and leading late night meetings and negotiations and always seems to have the energy of three people behind her. And while, yes, there is a lot more scrutiny of female leaders and elected officials than there tends to be of male, it's a legitimate question. Part of the reason it's a question is because her office has basically swatted back any details or answers and said it's not a problem. She herself has said as quickly as it came on, it will leave. Well, what is it? You know, there's really no details, so that leaves a lot of people to fill in the details and speculate wildly. But it would be, you know, it would be devastating if she were. We're getting way ahead of ourselves here. Of course, we have no idea what is actually wrong here. They've said dehydration. We'll wait and see if there's any information to fill in.
Dimitri?
I mean, I agree with what everyone has said about the sexism, and I think that totally exists. But I do think in this case, Angela Merkel is one of the most important leaders in the world. And if you look at the videos of her shaking, this is not a little minor thing. She is shaking uncontrollably.
It's pretty noticeable.
On three occasions, she has to clasp her hands to try and stop it. And now they're forcing her to sit down so that, you know, she's under less pressure. There's a clear question about her health. We don't know what it is. I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to speculate. But because she hasn't revealed any information about what's going on, it just makes it more... It makes it worse, and people are starting to suspect there's something going on there.
Let me stick with you, Dimitri, for a second, because speaking of the changing Europe, we should talk about Greece. There was some good news for another center-right party this week, because Greece elected a new prime minister. Kyriakos Mitsotakis and his New Democracy Party won a majority of seats in Greece's parliament, defeating the leftist prime minister, Alexis Tsipras. Now, Greece has been going through a lot in the last decade. Remind us, Dimitri, of what's been going on.
Well, I mean, Greece suffered massively because of the financial crisis globally and also because many of its own self-inflicted problems. Alexis Tsipras came in as prime minister on a platform of pushing back against some of the pressure from the European Union and the IMF to implement pro-austerity programs, which have sent Greek unemployment up to massive levels. It's actually improved. Greek unemployment is 18% today. You can imagine how high that is. But Tsipras over time had to accept some of the IMF and the European Union pressure because Greece was going to plunge out of the euro. So he was forced to do a slight U-turn. As a result, it's given an opportunity for the center-right New Democracy Party to come back. Mitsotakis is actually the son of a former prime minister, and Greece has a history of that kind of family members following the same footsteps of their parents. Another interesting thing about the Greek election, though, is that Golden Dawn, which is this far-right anti-immigrant party, which had done better in the last elections, didn't reach the threshold to have seats in parliament. So it's another example of what seems to be a slight kind of the pendulum in Europe coming back a little bit more towards the center, partly because the flow of refugees from Syria and the Middle East over the last 2 years has started to subside. And that was one of the huge drivers of the populist anti-immigration movements in Europe.
Much more to discuss when we continue with Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times, Laura Seligman of Foreign Policy, and Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour. Before we pause, 2008 was the last known public performance by a legendary musician, João Gilberto. His influence on music can still be heard everywhere. He is the boss of bossa nova, the inventor of it, really. And he's credited for modernizing the Brazilian music scene. João Gilberto died this week in Rio de Janeiro at the age of 88. You probably know his best-known song, a collaboration with jazz artist Stan Getz. It's a cover of The Girl from Ipanema, which became a worldwide hit after it came out in 1964. You could hear that and other bossa nova tunes playing outside his memorial at Rio's Municipal Theater, where loved ones and fans gathered for an unofficial farewell concert. We'll get back to the roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
a beleza que existe, a beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Back now to the roundup with Amna Nawaz, Dimitri Sevastopoulou, and Laura Seligman. Let's shift gears and talk about Hong Kong. After weeks of major protests there, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, suspended this controversial extradition bill that was behind the protests. Many of the protesters are skeptical that it is, as Lam claimed, dead. Amna Nawaz, why is there so much skepticism about the fate of this bill?
So this is an extradition bill that would basically allow Beijing to extradite suspected criminals from Hong Kong to the mainland. Obviously, for pro-democracy activists, that is a huge concern. And we saw those protests that have been unfolding for weeks now turn violent to some degree when a small group of them were able to break into the legislature and vandalize the area to some degree. It really ratcheted up pressure on Carrie Lam. Now, Carrie Lam has handled this by basically saying, no, the bill is dead. There was some very specific language that was used that wasn't satisfying to the protesters because for them, the bill only goes away if it is fully withdrawn. If it has no chance of ever being revived, of ever actually going to effect, that has not happened yet. So they are not yet satisfied. They are now locked in this battle with Carrie Lam, who's basically seen by them as a stooge of Beijing. And the demands are basically increasing too. This bill is not enough. They obviously want to be able to elect their own democratic candidates as well. They're worried, obviously, more largely about the influence that Beijing has on their government.
Laura, can we clarify a little bit what we mean by extradition? You know, it's one thing to want to have an extradition agreement with another country for murderers or terrorists or so on. The concern here, as I understand it, is that those kinds of criminals could certainly be extradited from Hong Kong back to mainland China, but it could also be just people who publish something on the web that Xi Jinping doesn't like.
Right, exactly. I think the real concern here is that Beijing is growing harsher and harsher in terms of in terms of imposing these really harsh things on Hong Kong, which has always been governed, seen itself as to some extent a separate country. So I think that the concern here is that I think the concern Beijing has is that if since this bill has been withdrawn or suspended, and because of this protest, I think the concern is Beijing looking weak in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of these protesters, and the real concern is that they think that this will send a signal that the government of Beijing will actually back down in the face of popular pressure. There have already been a lot of calls for more freedoms and democratic reforms. So I think the repercussions on this and what happens next, especially with Carrie Lam, whether she resigns or whether the government doubles down on this bill, I think could be pretty extreme. And the U.S. has now gotten involved in this, too. The national security team, Bolton, Pompeo, and Vice President Pence met with some Hong Kong activists recently, and this caused a lot of frustration in Beijing, particularly ahead of this upcoming U.S.-China meeting to try to defuse some of the trade talks. So this is definitely going to increase frustrations between the U.S. and China.
Now, contrast that, Dimitri, with some of your reporting from this week about some assurances that President Trump apparently gave to China's President Xi Jinping related to Hong Kong. What have you learned?
So I was at the G20 in Osaka where Trump and Xi met, and two things happened. In that meeting and in a phone call ahead of that meeting where the two leaders spoke, Donald Trump said to Xi Jinping that he or his administration would tone down criticisms of the erosion of freedoms in Hong Kong, which are basically sparked by China. Now, that doesn't prevent Pompeo and Mike Pence from meeting Jimmy Lai, the pro-democracy activist, and some other people, Martin Lee, a famous politician in Hong Kong. But Trump himself has actually said very, very little about what's been happening in Hong Kong. And just to put it in context, we talk about big marches in Hong Kong. One-third of the population, which is 2 million people, came out on the streets. Can you imagine if one-third of the population of America came out on the streets for something?
That would be more than 100 million people.
A huge story. And the kind of the backdrop here is that when Britain returned Hong Kong to mainland China, to the PRC in 1997, they came up with a 50-year arrangement, a one country, two systems, where Hong Kong maintains a separate legal system and everything except for foreign affairs is managed by Hong Kong. Foreign affairs is managed by Beijing. But in 2047, Hong Kong will revert to being a purely Chinese city. And there's a glide path from now until then where China is increasingly eroding the freedoms in Hong Kong. The people of Hong Kong don't have the ability to elect their leader. There's no universal suffrage, which is what sparked the huge protests, the Umbrella Revolution in 2014. And there's no real way to reverse this. The UK does criticize some of these things when they happen, but not very strongly. The US does criticize these abuses, but not very strongly. It's very difficult to reverse it. And I think the people of Hong Kong know that they really are on a slippery slope, and no one knows how you're going to change that situation.
Well, with regards to that slope, Amna, when you look at the protests from this extradition bill, the height of them, some of the most like violent, like the rioting and property destruction, you know, they broke into the legislature and kind of hung the old flag that flew during the British days when Hong Kong was part of the United Kingdom. This kind of feels like it's on this inexorable path to a conflict over 2047, where the people of Hong Kong know what the future looks like, but then there is this younger population that says, we don't care what deal you made, it's wrong, and we're not going to live in a Hong Kong like that.
It's really hard to see how this plays out. It's difficult to see how either side backs down at any point right now. Carrie Lam is in an untenable position, right? Because to Laura's point earlier, Beijing does not want to be seen to be negotiating with these activists, with a full third of the population there to back off and say, okay, if you do this again, we will relent on what we want to see happen. At the same time, a full third of the population is calling for greater control and agency over what happens to them in their own territory. And it's not just about this extradition bill. As I mentioned before, they've seen in the past when they've had some candidates and elected officials who were known to be pro-democracy removed by Beijing or prevented from running for office. There's been real direct influence there. So yes, tensions have been rising. The numbers have been growing. It's very difficult to see where and how any of this de-escalates anytime soon.
Laura?
Again, looking at the broader picture, this is not just about Hong Kong, right? This is about China and the greater dispute with the U.S. and with the rest of the world, which goes into trade. It goes into militarization of the South China Sea. So China just really does not want to be seen as backing down from its core values. And this is sort of could be seen as sort of the culmination of this, an example of this. And what happens next will really, I think, have an impact on the talks with the U.S. and China's leverage.
Well, increasingly, Dimitri, the world needs China. Like, China's too big a player. It's asserting too much of its influence across the South China Sea, parts of Africa. Like, it's not like some small country that we can say now. No, China's a player that the world can't really push around.
No, China is essentially on its way to becoming the second superpower. And with respect to Hong Kong, notwithstanding what's happening there and how we've arrived at this place, it's also important to point out that Hong Kong was originally part of China. The British came in and colonized it. So you can understand why the Chinese feel very strongly about Hong Kong. But I just wanted to make one point about the protests. While it's true that there are some very prominent violent incidents, the vast majority of those have been incredibly peaceful, to the point that back in 2014, I was living in Hong Kong. I took my 2-year-old son and 4-year-old daughter down to what was called Democracy Square because it was so peaceful. It was like going to a kind of Berkeley campus on a sunny day when everyone was out reading their books in the sun. So 2 million people protesting, actually the amount of violence compared to what it could be was really minimal. But it gets played up, obviously.
I used to teach at Berkeley. You just kind of took me back to 2016. And that is exactly what it's like on a Sunday afternoon, usually. A few more big stories we want to talk about before our time is up, including with regards to Turkey. It's a NATO member, and it just got its first shipment of a Russian missile defense system, which is something the U.S. has very strongly opposed. A number of you have commented on this. Brian emailed, "So Trump, the master negotiator, has lost a deal with a major ally in the Middle East to the Russians? Wow, I guess Trump really does trust Putin more than our long-term steadfast friends." That's kind of the crux of this issue, Lara, is that NATO is supposed to be this kind of bloc that has enough juice to oppose Russia, and now Turkey, which is kind of a black sheep member of NATO, is doing business with Russia.
Right. So there's a lot to unpack here. And one thing a lot of people don't know is that this has actually been a really long time coming. The U.S. has been offering Turkey a different missile defense system, the Patriot, since 2012, 2013. And Turkey actually turned it down twice before this deal that they made with Russia. And I think that the biggest implication that this could have is it really could potentially break Turkey from NATO. Or, first of all, it signals that Turkey is moving toward Russia, away from the United States, away from its NATO allies, because the U.S. has been signaling for a year now that it would have significant repercussions if Turkey does go through with this buy of the Russian missile system. So what's going to happen now is that the Trump administration is debating what kind of package of sanctions it's going to impose on Turkey because of this. Because due to the law, there is legislation saying that it would automatically trigger sanctions. The only question really is quite how devastating the sanctions will be. The most severe could be completely cutting the Turkish government or the Turkish Air Force off from the U.S. financial system, which would not only obviously hurt their business, but also scare off potential foreign investors as well. The bulk of the national security team is behind imposing the most severe sanctions on Turkey for this breach. But the one wild card could actually be the president himself, since, as you know, his personal relationship with Erdogan has previously led to some unexpected shifts in policy. So he could potentially choose to waive or delay these sanctions.
So there's the relationship between President Trump and President Erdogan of Turkey. There's also, Amna, this point that Ray in Virginia Beach, Virginia made. Love to know what you think of what he said. Ray emailed, "Why should NATO be angry with Turkey when our so-called NATO allies are planning a gas pipeline to purchase gas from the Russians? If there is a conflict, the Russians could cut off the gas as they did in Ukraine. Why give the Russians hard currency?" Is there a little bit of hypocrisy going on here?
Sure. There's always plenty of hypocrisy to go around, right? And that is a line we've heard from President Trump as well, which is, why am I being criticized for how I talk about Russia or how hard I am on Russia or not when you have this other deal that's going on? And that's absolutely true. To Laura's point earlier about what she pointed out was this: these relationships are shifting, and specifically between the U.S. and Turkey, it's a completely different relationship now, specifically between Trump and Erdogan, than it's ever been before. NATO is almost sort of just a backdrop against which is happening that doesn't quite matter as much anymore. But I interviewed Erdogan last year, and I'd asked him, this was at a time of sort of heightened tension because of whether or not the U.S. was going to keep troops in Syria. Of course, there was an interest in protecting our Kurdish allies in northern Syria. And there was a lot of tension between the two countries at that point.
Who the Turks do not like.
Exactly. And I had asked Erdogan, you know, do you even consider yourself an ally of the U.S. anymore? How do you see this relationship? And I'm paraphrasing what he's saying here, but it's basically been reduced to a transactional relationship. There is not a shared mission. There is not a deeper alliance upon which the two countries are working together. In areas where their interests overlap, Erdogan is happy to work with the U.S. In areas where he overlaps with Russia, he's happy to do that, too. And that's where we are today.
One more arms sales story, Laura, that we should mention, which has to do with Taiwan. It's also getting some new military equipment after the U.S. approved a $2.2 billion sale. Now, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen made a stop in the U.S. yesterday on her way to visit Caribbean allies. She spoke at a reception in New York. Here's part of what she said.
Taiwan will defend its democratic system. Our democracy hasn't come easily, and it's now being threatened by forces overseas.
That's Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen speaking yesterday in New York. Laura, can you just give us a brief sense of what the U.S. has agreed to sell Taiwan? And I'm sure China has reacted to that.
Yeah, so the U.S. in this most recent package has agreed to sell Taiwan $2.2 billion of Abrams tanks and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, which, it's certainly not the first time the U.S. has sold Taiwan arms. It is actually one of the primary arms sailors to Taiwan, but it is it would be the biggest package. The thing is that there is another arms package pending that is potentially three or four or five even times as large. It could be as much as $10 billion worth of F-16s, new F-16 fighter jets that the U.S. is trying to sell to Taiwan. And that is something that China has said would cross a red line. And that's something that would be extremely, extremely provocative and would surely prompt a backlash.
Dimitri, before we go?
It's important to point out that under U.S. law, the administration is required to provide Taiwan with defensive weapons. So you're essentially on a kind of a glide path here where increasingly, if the U.S. continues to provide weapons and China gets increasingly angry, at some point you could have a very dangerous situation. But this has been going on for some time.
So this is kind of an inexorable conflict in a way?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I had a kicker to read about Ringo Starr. And I know Ringo doesn't get much respect, but we're actually out of time. So I can't read it. I know. It's almost like I'm making it worse, aren't I? I'm making
so
it worse.
I'm disappointed.
Don't even. Because I heard what you said about Ringo during the break. I'm going to, you know what? I'm going to tweet out the kicker, doggone it, because Ringo needs love too. You got a problem with that, Amna?
I will retweet.
Well, thank you. I will hold you to that. Amna Nawaz, national correspondent and sub-anchor for the PBS NewsHour. Amna, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Thanks, Dimitri.
Thank you.
And Laura Seligman, Pentagon correspondent for Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Remember, on Fridays, there's a lot to take in, sometimes too much, Ringo Starr included. So, if you've missed any of the roundup, check out 1A's podcast. All the links to listen are online at npr.org/1A. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.